There, throughout my career, there are maybe 10 shots, I would maybe not even of shots that I really remember as like, wow, like this certainly meant a lot. The two tee shots I hit on Thursday, I teed off on 10 early in the morning, and the tee shot I hit on 10, the tee shot I hit on 11. I don't know if I'll ever forget the memory of hitting those two tee shots because it was the start of me climbing out of that hole and knowing that I was climbing out of that hole.
Welcome back to Any Given Monday. On this week, we talked to Michael Kim, one of the best follows on Twitter. I assume if you're listening to this, you probably follow Michael, but if not, go follow him. We talked about the state of pro golf, where he thinks his place is on the PGA Tour, whether he thought the leadership should have been better, whether he has a voice, whether he feels like he has a voice, but also is a great insight, not about today's state of pro golf today, but we talk about his climb after winning the John Deere Classic all the way back to where he is now, back as a member of the PGA Tour. He talks about a specific moment where swing changes that he was working on finally felt like they hit home. And it is a very cool, great insight into what players go through when they're struggling and going through swing changes and it feels kind of hopeless. It is a very, very cool moment. So listen for that. It's halfway through. And I appreciate him joining it. Without further ado, Michael Kim. All right, we're here with Michael Kim. Michael, first of all, probably the best follow on Twitter. It wasn't a let's start there. We'll get into Jon Rahm and where your place on the tour is and all those kind of things. But was it a conscious decision to kind of just be not outspoken, but just like share more on Twitter, or did it kind of just evolve into that?
Yeah, it was definitely a bit of a conscious decision. Last year in the fall, I played with Max Homa, and Max to me is a dear friend and a college teammate. And, to me, he's not really like top 10 in the world, Twitter famous Max Homa. He's just my friend Max Homa growing up. And I think it was a bit of a surprise. It really was surprising to see the following that he had at the Safeway Open. And to see how much his brand has grown. And I think from that point on, I decided to get a little more into it. I tried to think about what my basically content would be. And, it'd be obviously golf, but I certainly didn't want to be one of those guys where it's the kind of your everyday PGA Tour kind of Instagram or Twitter stuff where it's just like, hey, I'm here at this tournament, hoping for a good week. Like no one really cares for that kind of stuff. And so I try to think about, what my lane could be, and, through my journeys and ups and downs as a pro golfer, I feel like I've learned a lot about golf, certainly way more than I had, in the years prior. So I felt like I could kind of share some of that to the amateur golfers, and it's grown a lot faster than I thought, but it's been cool to see the responses.
Let's talk about your journey. You've had the ups and downs of exactly what I cover. So do people understand your career, Michael? Like if like a general fan, I feel like my account, I get asked a lot of questions, but obviously you're on the inside, I'll never be a player. Do like friends and family and like maybe the casual golf fan or acquaintance kind of think your life looks different than it might? Not that you're not like appreciative and you make good money and those kind of things, but do they maybe not understand what a professional golf life looks like?
Maybe. I mean, unless you're a really hardcore fan, which I assume most that are listening to this podcast are probably hardcore. They probably have a much better understanding thanks to accounts like yourselves and whatnot. But the casual fan, I think you know, even in my Twitter replies, it's like they assume that every one of us flies private, and like, you know, they have these like crazy numbers in their heads of what we get paid, like, or whatever, with like our logos and whatnot. And don't get me wrong, we are very, I'm very well off financially compared to just about everyone except John Rahm. But, you know, it's certainly a lot more stressful than I feel like most people realize. And, you know, everyone loves job security, and the PGA Tour, unless you're a winner, it offers zero job security. And that is, I feel like most of the mid to back end guys, their number one goal is to not, is to keep their card. Like, to be frank, it's not to, you know, it's not to like win majors and be the best or whatnot. It's actually most of us are to keep our jobs. And it's, you know, most casual fans might not understand that. But you know, to be honest, like they don't really, I feel like they don't need to as much. They can, as long as you enjoy the product, it doesn't matter. I guess it doesn't matter as much.
Like early season, like let's just take for instance the Sony. Like, do you consciously look at, like at a shot to shot basis, final round, you have a chance to be in the top 10. You realize how those points could affect you at the end of the year. Are you thinking about that ever on the course, Michael? You already said you think about it as a whole season, but are you looking at it as a shot by shot? I'm like early in the season. Is it have to be part of your thoughts until you lock it up, or is that just kind of after rounds and as a general oversight of like, hey, I got to keep my job?
It's not there that early in the year. You know, we focus so much on the shot, and we just want to, whether it's like an 8-foot birdie putt, you just want to make that 8-footer so bad. And you know, all that, like trying to keep my job, trying to make money, trying to do the best you can, it's all wrapped into that mindset of me really wanting to make this 8-foot birdie putt or whatever. So it's all part of it all. But on a shot by shot basis, I'm not going to be like on the 15th hole on a Saturday, you know, even if I'm, you know, close to the lead, you just want to pull off that one shot, and that's in the background, but I wouldn't say it's in the forefront.
Let's talk. And I know we're shortening up a career that had ups and downs, but you win the 18 John Deere, you struggle, you make some significant swing, ball flight, coach changes after struggling for a while. Is it at that point, Michael, like I got to change something, or is it still scary to make significant changes like that?
You know, at that point I had made a really big change from my coach that I grew up with and I had through my junior and college, and you know, helped me get to my PGA Tour card in James O. And 3 or 4 weeks before the deer, I made a big change, and you know, obviously it worked out. I ended up winning on the PGA Tour, and I kind of assumed that, you know, I'm on the right path, and I just kind of keep continuing on that path. And I'm going to win more tournaments and, you know, contend in majors and all that. But oftentimes it doesn't work out the way you think. And I still feel like your heart is always in the right place. I was looking for a long-term plan, a long-term process of, you know, how to get to where we want, you know, top 50 in the world or and all that. But, you know, it just, for whatever reason, it didn't work out as well. and that kind of, that ended up throwing me in a spiral of, you know, trying to search for, I don't want to say like answers to golf, but just trying to figure out how I can improve and play better golf. And that took a lot longer than I hoped or and expected, but you know, at the end of the day, I'm here. I found a better way to play through a new coach in Sean Foley. And now I guess I'm way more on the better side.
Is the hardest part of those moments, like when you're, you know, you're struggling and you're making significant changes, is to trust the process? Michael, I assume as a pro, you're like looking for some sort of sign that like this process isn't working and they're not always there, whether that's on a week to week basis or a round to round basis. Is the hardest part that you just have to trust, like make the decision that you're making the right moves and trust that for X amount of time?
I think the toughest, one of the toughest parts when I was in that hole, it's every week's a kind of a new week, and every week you get your hopes up and thinking like, okay, maybe this week might be better. I think I figured something out talking with my coach, and you know, I'm hitting it pretty well on the range. You know, I think I'm feeling better, and every, you know, week, every day leading up to that next week of Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you start feeling better. You start feeling that hope. And then you get to Thursday. And for me anyway, it was kind of a big crash of like kind of a here we go again type thing, feeling. And that is that continual crash on tournament days. And then the hope up and then the crash. And then it's like, well, like, is it ever gonna show up during tournament play? And the frustrating part for me was during practice, if anybody watched me hit shots on the range, you wouldn't have thought for one second that I was struggling. Mm-hmm. And I was also a tough part where I couldn't trust my practice. It's like, I don't really know what to work on the range, because it's not, the bad shots that I'm seeing on the golf course aren't even showing up on the range. So, you know, that was a really tough part for me to figure out how do I improve the tournament stuff? Cause the range stuff was totally fine.
I assume that's the hard part to explain to people like myself, is like your swing on the range and swing under pressure are just, they're different animals. It's just all there is to it. And so, is that part of the process, Michael, is just like, hey, I know I'm doing the right things, it's eventually going to show up? Or do you start to question, like, am I making the right moves here because it's not showing up?
Definitely both. You know, I assume most of your listeners haven't played on the PGA Tour, but, you know, a lot of them, I'm sure, have played some type of, not even tournament golf, but any type of round where they really want to, it has a lot of consequence or and meaning to them, and you can feel how your body reacts, you know, in those circumstances, and where your brain kind of wants to go to, and in most likely in a negative negative space. And you know, we feel that just a little bit more intensely, just because, you know, our livelihoods and you know what it means for us to be on the PGA Tour and everything that kind of goes in with that. So, you know, lots of people assume that, you know, we're the best golfers in the world and we hit every shot with supreme confidence and no worry at all. I remember hearing a story of a guy like complaining about a tee shot, and a friend was like, who is better prepared to hit this tee shot than you? Like a top, you know, 200 golfer in the world. And I just couldn't stop laughing, because Logically, that makes all the sense in the world, right. But sometimes in our heads,
T-shots are still scary.
It's still, you know, our bodies move differently, but our brains work incredibly similarly to everyone else. So, that I remember that just laughing at that, because I've certainly have had, you know, those thoughts like, this T-shot or this shot, I just don't know what to do. But you know, I've literally trained almost my entire life, you know, to hit these certain shots. So right. I probably should have, there's no reason for me to think that way, but our brain kind of goes there.
Yeah. When you're climbing out of this hole, Michael, do you remember a specific time, or is it the same thing? It's gradual. Like, hey, that 74 might turn into a 72 and it's still a miscut and people aren't seeing it that aren't a player. Or is it, do you remember some, like a particular shot or a particular round where it's like, oh, okay, this is starting to come together?
Certainly. For those that don't know, I lost my PGA Tour card in 2022. The COVID, the years, and it all gets kind of messed up a little bit.
For what season ended and started? Yeah,
especially because not anymore, but the season starts in the fall and extends anyway, it doesn't matter.
1 year you lost your status and we're playing.
1 year I lost my status on the PGA Tour and went back to Korn Ferry Tour. And kind of right at that point where I lost my card, I had gone to see Sean Foley. And we changed a few things and, you know, things were starting to feel good. And I went to the Panama tournament. That's one of the first, I want to say maybe the third tournament, third event of the year.
Yeah.
And Panama is usually Korn Ferry courses are on the easier side. You make a lot of birdies, but Panama is like a real test. I want to say maybe 12 or 15 under wins that tournament every year. And it's, you have to hit your ball well. And I was starting to feel pretty good about my swing. It felt a little different kind of in the practice sessions. I really felt like I was understanding what Sean wanted me to do, and it felt pretty natural. And I went in and, just the Thursday round, I hit it better than I had hit in a really long time. And not only was the ball going straighter, but how my swing felt during the round was way different. It felt like I was fighting my own body to make these changes, but this time it felt pretty smooth. I hit the ball really well on that Thursday and the entire week. And if I had putted better, I would have easily been in like the top five. I think I finished maybe 14th or 15th. And I remember I sent Sean a text like, hey, I don't, you know, it feels funny that I'm texting you this after a top 15 on the Korn Ferry Tour, but you know, I know that we're on the right pace. Like, thank you. Like, you know, I know we have a foundation. I know we can build off of this, and you know, whatever happens the rest of the year, I know we're on the right track. That tournament was a really big week, and it took me a little bit to kind of get everything going after that. But I started playing really, you know, some really solid golf starting in maybe May and June, and kind of got, you know, started playing some good golf and ended up getting my tour card that season.
I mean, the way you just look back at it, Michael, I mean, when you rank important events in your career, I know there's a lot of process leading up to that, but you have to look back at that as like an important, the best T15 or whatever you finished of your career is like I assume the mental side of it is so vital. Like, hey, we're getting over this hump that you felt like you would never get over.
100%. Like there, you know, throughout my career, there are maybe 10 shots. Maybe not even of shots that I really remember as like wow, like this certainly meant a lot. And, you know, some of them are from the John Deere when I won. But, you know, the two tee shots I hit on Thursday, I teed off on 10 early in the morning, started on 10. And the tee shot I hit on 10, the tee shot I hit on 11 were, I don't know if I'll ever forget the memory of hitting those two tee shots, because it was the start of me climbing out of that hole and knowing that I was climbing out of that hole. Oftentimes for me, when I was going through the struggle, it feels like I'm in just like a really dark cave, and there's a lot of these roads, and you pick a road and you think that's the road that's going to lead you out, but it ends up just going to a deeper hole. But you know, that when I actually pick the right road and I'm on the right track, you know, it's certainly an amazing feeling and a massive kind of monkey off your back and all that.
Yeah. I mean, that was amazing insight, Michael. And I assume those tee shots are not because they're good tee shots. You hit plenty of good tee shots in between your win and your downtime. It's that you knew what the hell was going to happen. Like, you knew what was happening. Your swing fate changes felt natural. It felt different, right?
Correct. It's, you know, even, I mean, at the end of the day, I am a professional golfer, and no matter how deep in the hole I was, I hit plenty of good shots.
Sure.
During that process, but at the tour level, when guys are really playing well, it's when you hit that swing, everything feels like the sequencing feels great. A lot of times the ball might go straight, but the swing really felt hard to make that ball go straight, where it's like a flash of the hands at impact, or you feel like you're fighting your body. And that's a very, even though the ball went straight, that's a very uncomfortable feeling, because you know it's not going to last. Like, that's not going to last throughout the entire tournament, especially if you get into more stressful, nervous, you know, contend or whatever situations. But when the swing everything feels smooth and easy, that's when you know it's going to last. You don't know how long. You try to prolong it as much as you can. But I hadn't felt that in tournament round in a really, really long time. And it was such a liberating feeling.
Michael, I mean, I assume you have more of an inside look than any of us. Obviously, you're as a player, but like, what?
I don't know.
I mean, you do tweet like, I'm following along with you guys. Like, what has the last 2 weeks been like for you? Is it fan? Do you separate yourself as a player? Kind of like when your tweet was, I'm sad that Jon Rahm is not on the PGA Tour, but I'm happy because I don't have to compete against him anymore. I'm sure said somewhat tongue in cheek, but how is your feelings of the last like week and a half? It seems to have like sped up to 90 all of a sudden since Jon.
I think, you know, to be really honest with you guys, like, I am certainly right in the middle of it. With the whole PGA Tour and the LIV and PIF negotiations going on, but at the same time, there's not much I know I can do. I don't have a ton of input. I am oftentimes just catching up stuff on Twitter about, you know, certain rumors, and there's so many rumors going around that you have to ignore so many of them. But you know, specifically with Jon, I think everyone was even more surprised because he had been pretty outspoken about his support for the PGA Tour. And I think, you know, he talked a lot about the format and why he doesn't like, you know, maybe the 54 holes or the shotgun and all that. But, you know, to me, I'm really happy for Jon that he got the amount that he got. But it doesn't really change my bottom line a whole lot, I don't think. Like, even if these negotiations go just terribly wrong. I don't see the PGA Tour disappearing because of that. At the end of the day, you know, I think it's going to work out. Maybe that's just very optimistic. And clearly, the John signing was a pretty strategic move from the PIF. But you know, at the end of the day, I think everyone will come together and they will figure it out. And you know, I'm going to be playing the Sony, you know, this upcoming January, and it doesn't really affect me a ton. And as long as I play good golf, you know, things will work out in the end.
Are you concerned, like, you've won on the PGA Tour? Obviously, you've had success, Michael. Are you concerned, you know, you didn't get the email from someone who sent out the bottom 70? It feels like, obviously, I'm biased, so I'm not trying to pretend like it feels like the bottom half of the PGA Tour, or the middle and down, is kind of getting squeezed out. Now, obviously, I'm totally understanding that the top players drive everything. I get that. Do you feel like, not you specifically, but the group that you belong in, maybe from the top 50 down or top 70 down, don't have a voice? Are you concerned that that is getting lost?
Well, to be fair, I don't even know how much of a voice I had beforehand anyway. You know, the tour has to look out for 200 odd members, and it's natural that the guys like Rory and Tiger and Jordan are going to have that influence, as they should. You know, I was never too involved or too into the process of the PGA Tour. I was always basically been told, like, you know, whatever issues you might have, just play it a little better, and most of those issues go away. And to be honest, that part hasn't changed much. I think, you know, communication has been an issue with the PGA Tour since I was a rookie, and I'm pretty confident it was an issue before that. And I do think they are trying to make an effort of, you know, sending these, you know, once a month ish emails to us. And, you know, there's probably more of a direct line with Jason Gore being in there as well. So, to be honest, I don't know what a ton has changed. I think everyone was really, really shocked and surprised at how the merger was so, you know, quickly announced, and the process of all that. But, you know, look, like, the tour, you know, I think, I don't know how much more I can say, but, like, I think there is probably going to be a review of the whole process after all this kind of gets kind of figured out. So, mm-hmm. you know, we'll kind of go from there.
Do you individually feel like Jay has the trust? You know, I've heard from so many players, Michael, that kind of this process has lost trust in the leadership. Do you fall into that category? Do you trust the PGA Tour? That's what it comes down to.
To be frank, I do. Like, I trust the tours, the overall brand of the PGA Tour. I still trust. There's, you know, no matter how successful LIV is, like, unless they somehow mesh with the PGA Tour, I still think it's going to be a no rating, just money grab for the most part. You know, the tour it's still the biggest brand, and it's still the best way to get world ranking points into the majors. And, you know, it's still on TV with decent, maybe not decent, but ratings that are certainly way better than the LIV. And, you know, it's tricky, right? If the LIV and PIF hadn't come along, I feel like no one would have, you know, it would have been 1% of all the outrage that we've been having. And it's tough. I still trust the the brand. I still think, you know, I've spoken to Jay not too many times, but he's obviously, you know, I still feel like he can still kind of get us out of this. Maybe, you know, I don't want to quite say whole, but it's whatever happens, I still have faith in the PGA Tour, and I think that's probably the best answer I can give.
Is there any, like, we focus a lot, all of us, media, myself, focus on the negative of what's happened to golf, whether you're on the live side or the PGA Tour side. Is there any good that comes from this, do you think, Michael, in the long run? I think it's given players a voice that maybe the PGA either stifled or it was kept behind closed doors at the very least. Is there, you know, in 5 years, is this, I know there's tons of negative that could obviously happen, but is there some positives that have come from this?
I think the issues that everyone is having is it's been so much about the money and so much about the players. And the players, look, I've certainly benefited from all this happening. The purses have gone up. If I play better and I get inside the top 50, you know, I will for sure be making way more money than I have in years past. There's has been almost zero talk about how it's beneficial for the fans. And, you know, I think the tour can certainly do a better job with trying to figure out a better fan experience. And, you know, hopefully with this, if the merger or whatever you want to call it happens, there will be a new influx of cash coming in. And hopefully we'll be able to use that to better the fan experience as well. And not just think about, you know, our tournament purses or the PIP or stuff like that. Yeah.
There's basically, if you're a top player, there's some rumblings that you're leaving. I mean, are you concerned about what happens next? It feels like, Michael, that like John has kind of opened the floodgates of like, you got to go get paid if you're going to go get paid. Is that, as a player, does it feel like that?
I, you know, a lot of the middle to bottom guys don't even have that option. So I think we're like a guy like me, we're not too focused on it. I think if you're a guy like, I don't want to put out names, but just a top 20 guy, sure. I certainly think those thoughts are, I mean, how could you not think about it with some of the paydays that these guys are getting? I mean, Shohei Ohtani just signed for, was it 600 or 700, 700 million for 10 years. And he's literally the biggest baseball star in the world in a much bigger sport, obviously. So,
yeah.
And John got, you know, who knows what the actual number is, but
yes,
you know,
it's more than that, at least on a per year basis.
We know. Sure. Sure. For those, however long his contract is, but it's, you know, it's crazy. It's you see all these deals happening, and as a top player, I don't know how you couldn't think about, you know, what if I went? And I'm sure if a top 10, 15 guy called whoever, I'm sure a deal would show up, you know, within a few days. So I don't know how you wouldn't be able to think about it. And I'm sure they currently are, especially with John leaving. And, you know, if these negotiations, you know, continue on at a pretty brisk pace, as I'm sure it's probably looking that way. I'm sure some players are thinking like, all right, he got paid. Like, what about, you know, is this the last chance maybe that I might be able to get that big of a payday? And there's that. I feel like for the top players, there's almost that fear of these guys that took the early payday and they get to come back and play the exact same schedule and have the exact same benefits that the top, you know, 15 guys are enjoying, and they get the best of both worlds, but they feel left out. And, you know, it's a lot of jealousy and greed, but if you're a top player, it's impossible not to be having those thoughts, to me.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. No matter what you said, I think 600 million, if that's the number, is a wild, wild number.
It's staggering number. Like, we just throw out that number like it's 600, but like it is a staggering number.
Yeah. I mean, again, I've said it many times on Twitter. I'm not a Liv fan. It's not for me. It obviously is opposite of what I cover. But if they said, Ryan, hey, we're going to do Monday qualifiers and we're going to pay you $1.5 million. See you later. So, I mean, it's like, again, they just stuck a number in front of them that eventually just said no. All right. We'll close on this. Yasser's listening. He's not, but let's see. What's the number, Michael? What is the number?
I think I asked him for whatever number he wants or he feels.
Okay.
I feel he feels deemed worthy and we'll go for
breaking for news. Michael Kim is going to be on the Cleeks or whatever. I don't know any of the teams.
yeah. I mean, I certainly would listen.
Yeah,
to see
everybody.
How could you not?
Who's reasonable, Michael, would say that they would listen. I mean, you have to.
Certainly would. Well, I don't know, because apparently the PGA Tour some didn't listen in the early parts. So, but you know, I'm sure I'd listen. But you know, I am very happy with where I'm at with my life.
If everybody keeps leaving, you might be in these events.
You might 100%. You know, I put it out on Twitter.
Yeah, you tweeted about Matt. It's like
stoked. I'm sure. and you know, if the rumors are right, and a couple more guys, and maybe you know, maybe by January, I might be in the first signature event. So we'll see.
100%. I mean, there's plenty of guys who have their PGA Tour cards still because of guys leaving.
And that's right. That's right. Yeah. So,
I'm sure they're in the same boat that you tweeted about. Sad to see them go, but kept their job. So, Michael, I appreciate it. Best follow on Twitter. You're amazing. I appreciate it. Appreciate the time. Thanks again.
Thank you.